I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today I'm going to tell you about cloned beef. I've eaten it, and I'll explain some of the big issues behind this mystery meat. The nation's bees are dying, and no one knows why. More on the implications and the scope of this potential disaster. A woman finds her soul over a pizza pie. Jonathan Gold is here, and a history of vegetarianism as well. First, let's see what's in season at the farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Hey, we've caught up with David Karp, the fruit detective, who is at the market in between traveling around the world doing amazing, in-depth, fascinating research on all kinds of fruit. And David has just finished doing quite a bit of research on tangerines, a.k.a. mandarins, one of the most popular citrus fruits, one of the most high-value citrus fruits, and one of the most up-and-coming citrus fruits, I would say, at the markets and in California. So, David, as usual, you've got a bag of samples. You've been all over the place. Tell us what you've been finding out about tangerines.
Well, tangerines are the last of the species of citrus to go seedless. When it comes to tangerines, they're highly sexually active, i.e. they've got very virile pollen and tend to be very fertile. So, for example, the Dancy tangerine, we're standing here next to Friends Ranch, is the prototypical tangerine. That's seedy. It's also very highly flavored. It's delicious. There have been seedless forms around for a century and a half or more, namely the Satsuma, which is early in season for the most part. It's like October, November, December is peak season. And although it can be very good, it's not as high flavored as, say, a clementine, which is about as good as a tangerine or tangerine hybrid can get. There's a battle royale looming between California mandarin growers who want their fruit to be seedless and beekeepers who want to station their hives next to the groves in order to nourish their bees. A lot of the varieties that could and should be seedless for to get yield the best results for the growers are seeded if they're grown next to other citrus, like lemons, Valencia oranges, grapefruit, and so forth.
And the bees being and there would cause the pollen to cross-pollinate and put the seeds where they didn't want the seeds to be. Is that
exactly
the problem?
If you have a beekeeper stationed next to a grove, there's so many seeds in them, you practically have to use a hacksaw. So scientists are working like mad to get the seeds out of tangerines. How do they do that? Well, sometimes they're just lucky, and for example, the Gold Nugget, which Friends also sells, is just naturally seedless. But then he also sells the Tahoe Gold, which is one of the new so-called TDEs released by the University of California at Riverside, and they're seedless because they have an extra set of chromosomes, believe it or not. Most citrus, just like humans, have two sets of chromosomes. They're diploid. But breeders were able to come up with a triploid with three sets of chromosomes, and the genetic imbalance renders them seedless.
Now, a bee could not come along and ruin everything and put the seeds back in if a bee got in that orchard?
Good question. If a bee actually gets into that orchard, sometimes you do get those tiny little aborted seeds, the little nuggets, seed traces they're called in the industry. But there's another way that's coming down the pike that's going to be increasingly important and you might want to know about. Irradiation of budwood. I know that sounds scary. It's sort of like irradiating meat to get the germs out when there shouldn't be any germs to begin with.
Right.
Well, this is actually very different. You're irradiating the budwood, that is the stem for propagating, and hoping to induce a mutation. Some of the trees look really weird and distorted. In some cases, actually, flowers sprout from the thorns. But once in like 1,000 times, you'll get the perfect mutation, exactly what you're looking for, and it'll be exactly the same as the parent variety, except it'll be seedless. And that's what they did to the W. Murcott afuera. That would bring glee to the hearts of beekeepers, because then they would no longer be on the mat about having to be responsible for pollinating somebody else's orchard and causing seeds when they're not wanted. And I don't think that there's any health problem. It's not like genetically modified or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, are these proprietary and they can only be brought from a breeder, or can they be propagated by, if you have some, you can start grafting your own on your own trees?
You're not supposed to be able to do so. It's a licensed variety, $2 a tree from the University of California. That's the name of the game these days, intellectual property rights.
Wow, didn't on used the, to be the food case. That we eat, that is, it's going into scary territory if you ask me, but
yeah,
I guess that's the future.
By inducing minor mutations, like just being sterile and not having any seeds, they're able to come up with, for example, a completely seedless Valencia, which is about to be released in Florida.
Amazing. Now, what is your favorite tangerine? We have several fantastic tangerine varieties here at the market.
And actually, my favorite among those that are available at the market right now are Bob Polito's Fina clementines, or Algerian clementines.
Yeah, those are very good.
You get the small ones, they're seedless. You get the large ones, sometimes they have seeds, and they're just perfect right now.
In spite of all that frost. Yeah.
Man, I haven't had a bad one. If you're a mandarin these days and want to ensure a numerous brood, the best thing is to be sterile. ironically enough, paradoxically.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, this is spoken by the man who's been out there doing the research. It's like the Indiana Jones conclusion here of the exotic mandarin growing techniques around the world. That's so interesting, David.
Thanks so much, Laura.
David's article on tangerines should be appearing in this Wednesday's New York Times food section or in a subsequent issue very soon to follow. Now we're visiting with our favorite market shopper, chef, recipe provider, and cookbook writer, cooking show host, Amelia Saltzman. Your list of credits keeps growing. Amelia, and we're going to ask her for what's inspiring her to cook today. And, well, Amelia, what are those gorgeous roots?
Rutabagas. They're almost carrot-shaped, wouldn't you say?
Or beet-shaped? Yeah, I think of a rutabaga as being around like a turnip shape. These look like fat carrots or parsnips.
Yes, and what I like to do is just sauté them simply with a little carrot to bring out the golden color, onion, and turn it into a soup. Just scrub them, peel them, cut them into coins the way you would a carrot. Mm-hmm. A little butter in a pot, medium-low heat for, 10 minutes to soften them. Then add some vegetable stock, puree what you've got, and then thin the soup to the texture of heavy cream, let's say the thickness of cream. The rutabagas on their own are a miraculous taste.
They really are.
And most people don't realize it. I certainly didn't. Mm-hmm. They're nutty. They're sweet.
Great. Yeah. Well, they are beautiful, and they look like either a carrot or some sort of a radish or something. So when in doubt, ask. All right. Amelia has got the eye and the taste buds, and we really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman with yet another recipe that even I can probably memorize just talking to her that I can't wait to try. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
For what to eat in this great city of ours, I love to turn to food writer Jonathan Gold. He's a true omnivore and a frequent contributor to our appetites. He's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Once again, it is that time where we have a very special guide to a restaurant here in Southern California. Our guide today is Jonathan Gold, known for his incredible writing in his counterintelligence columns in the LA Weekly. Where are we going today?
We are going to Westlake. The restaurant we're doing today is Chichen Itza, which is a restaurant specializing in the food of the Yucatan. Some of you may know Chichen Itza from its first incarnation as a food stand in the splendid Mercado La Paloma south of downtown, where it was one of many restaurants in a food court. This is a full-fledged restaurant, a nice place with the approved bright Mexican colors on the walls and nice glasses and waiters dressed up.
Not a joint.
It's not a joint. It's a good place. Again, what they specialize in is the same sort of Yucatan food that they had at their original restaurant, which is to say appetizers like panuchos, which are fried tortillas that are crisp and filled with beans and topped with turkey and pickled onions.
They're just – I could hurt myself with panuchos.
You can eat about a million of them.
Oh, man.
And cozitos, which are like little taquito things in tomato sauce. And their version of the Yucatan version of kibbe, which is the same as the Middle Eastern one. There's a really big Lebanese population in Mérida, the capital.
Is it called kibbe?
It's called kibbe.
I love that.
And it's ground beef and cracked wheat formed into balls, deep fried, served with the various garnishes. And it's especially good with their under-the-counter hot sauce.
Now, why is it under-the-counter?
There are several hot sauces there. One is the one they automatically bring out for the table. It's a mild sauce. My 3-year-old kid likes to eat it. Then they have, if you look plaintively at them, they'll bring you this liquidy, I think it's habanero mango. It's very hot. It's a very sort of mean, nasty, beautiful, wonderful, fragrant, pungent heat that makes everything that it touches better. I would put it on ice cream. And then if you look even more plaintively, then they bring you the egg goods, which is roasted habanero peppers, chopped coarsely, mixed with a little bit of sour orange juice, and served plain. And amount of it, the size of a match head, is enough to blow the top of your head off. But it's so pleasurable doing so.
And that's a really good accompaniment to something like kibbeh. It's perfect.
It is. They have some Yucatan dishes that are really popular in places in, you know, Merida, but you never see here, like stuffed Gouda cheese.
Is it a thick slice of Gouda that has a slit in it and something's put in there?
It's like, yeah, a big sort of a third of a ball of Gouda, and there's a ground meat and raisins and nuts, and it's sweet and it's wonderful.
And is it baked or is it fried or is it?
I think it's baked, but it's hard to tell. It comes out as a very big saucy thing. The things that you would expect them to have are pretty good. They do cochinito pibil, of course, which is the pork, you know, rubbed with achiote and other spices and wrapped in banana leaves and baked until it almost collapses.
What was your favorite thing?
My favorite thing, and it's something I wasn't even expecting to see, was something that's called on the menu a tikkun cheek, which is flounder that has been marinated in the same sort of spices that you would expect in pibil and grilled. So it's like nice and soft and flaky on the inside and served with a jicama salad with orange segments. You wouldn't expect to be good because it sounds really plain, but it's just perfect. The sourness and the crunch against the sort of like lushness and spice of the fish is perfect.
So once again, tell us where we are going to.
The restaurant is Chichen Itza, and it is at 2501 West 6th Street in Los Angeles.
Jonathan Gold joins us frequently on Good Food, and he writes a column each week for the LA Weekly. Factories can produce most of what we eat, but there are fruits and nuts that can only exist with the help of bees. Between panicked humans exterminating entire colonies of bees and this latest and mysterious mass die-off, the future for bees is uncertain. I'll be back next with an update on the situation and an attempt to explain what's going on. I'll be right back on Good Food. If the apocalyptic feelings coming from global warming weren't enough, now we have the collapse of an essential insect population. Bees are dying all across the country. They are disappearing from their hives and not coming back, and no one knows why. Bees are critical for fruit industries like peaches, plums, and nectarines. They are also essential for California's gigantic almond crop. Here to give us an overview of this bewildering problem is New York Times writer Alexi Barranuevos. Alexi, we should start with a science lesson and explain how bees pollinate things like an almond tree.
What's amazing about the honeybees is that they're really natural pollinators. Not only are they going in and getting this specific nectar, but the nectar ends up getting attached to their rump, if you will, to the body of the bee. And then when they go back into the hive, it sort of bounces around among the bees, and then another bee will leave the hive and go out and go to a different tree, and then ends up being sort of a cross-pollination effort, which is exactly what the almond growers want to ensure the, you know, the best crops.
Now, is there any sort of modern, non-natural process that can mimic what the bees do on this kind of scale?
Not really. There have been efforts over the decades to try to sort of do without the bees. I mean, everything from firing mortar shells over cropland to try to spread pollen, you know, artificial pollen across the trees. But there's nothing that's as precise as a honeybee at pollinating that goes right into that flower and gets exactly what's needed and pulls it out. Everything else is just a real rough approximation, and those efforts have been unsuccessful.
Could you describe what people are referring to as colony collapse disorder, just to explain what exactly is happening?
What investigators believe is happening, what they're observing, is that literally the bees are just sort of disappearing. Beehives and colonies are sort of one and the same in the parlance of the beekeeping industry. And they're usually big boxes of bees, and they have frames, as they call them, that have tens of thousands of bees on each frame. And they'll take these bees out, and literally they will fly off when the temperature is warm enough and go off and pollinate the flowers. And then when the temperature gets cold again, they will go back to the hive. And they always find their way back because they kind of make mental pictures along the way of where they are. They find their way back to their hives every night. But what's happened is now the bees are not coming back to the hives. So they're not finding lots of dead bees in the hives. They're just not finding the bees. Presumably, they are falling off out in the fields and dying, but certainly there's some efforts to investigate whether they're getting lost, literally, and whether their neurological functions are being affected as such, and they just can't find their way back.
Is there any anecdotal stories about field workers finding a lot of dead bees out in the fields, or confused bees that are just buzzing around?
Well, it'd be hard to know if they were confused bees buzzing around. But there have been some bees found in the fields, and they've taken some of those bees to study. That's what's so frustrating about this to both the investigators and the beekeepers themselves, is there's simply just not a lot of evidence of what's happening. Bees are gone. The bees can fly a reasonable distance before they pass away. But the problem is bees will die of exposure. As we said, that they can't really handle the cold. And so if they're flying around, you know, aimlessly in the evening hours, they're going to really pass away from exhaustion. And, who knows where that will be.
Is colony collapse disorder happening in other countries on a scale as large as ours?
There have been some bee loss scenarios, certainly in recent years in other parts of the country, particularly in France and Spain. In France, several years ago, there were so many bee losses that the French government complained to the German government. They were accusing a company in Germany of producing a group of pesticides called nicotinoids that act like, as it sounds, they have nicotine in them, low levels of nicotine, sort of sublethal doses, supposedly, and that supposedly they were supposed to kill certain kinds of insects, and they were maybe perhaps killing the bees off as well. In the end, the French government banned that group of pesticides. It's hard to say whether or not the situation for bees has improved that much. Similarly, there have been issues in Spain in recent years, and it's not really clear what happened there. It may be a kind of protozoa that they're studying here in the U.S. that may have affected the Spanish bees, although some people are wondering or suspicious of whether or not genetically modified crops may have been partially to blame there. And certainly genetically modified crops here in the U.S. are one of the areas that their investigators are exploring. They're not convinced because it seems that if you had a genetically modified crop that was killing off the bees, you would see more of a poison-like effect on the bees. I mean, there are all kinds of crazy theories. I mean, I thought one of them was pretty crazy until I talked to an investigator this morning who said they're actually looking into whether cell phone towers are somehow disorienting the bees. That's another weird one because it doesn't seem that you would have a phenomena that's in so many states now, some more than 24 states, some of these places where there just aren't that many cell phone towers near, you know, where these crops are being planted. What's so tough about this situation in the United States right now is that it appears there's something going on a broad scale. And so there are a lot of localized potential answers that end up being discounted, by the investigators, or at least put on the back burner, because it doesn't seem like those apply to all regions of the country where the bees are disappearing in such major numbers. So that's what's tricky.
I just wanted to ask you a couple questions about the almond crop, because I think it's something that very few of us really think about, just the sheer size of it. I know that you had the opportunity to fly over the orchards here in California.
Oh, it's phenomenal. I was really blown away. As we were flying, the grower was explaining that a lot of these almond fields now are the property of investment banks, hedge funds, etc., that are getting into this crop. It's really sort of a gold rush scenario. I mean, the crop is extremely profitable, and it is one of the best export crops that America has right now. There's no real competitor to the United States right now anywhere in the world. But the prices have been falling off a little bit the last 2-3 years. They got to a peak 2-3 years ago, and this is when, in a way, the bee issues began. The cost to pull in beehives shot up from about $35 a bee colony to $135 in just a few weeks.
Wow.
And suddenly you had truckloads of bees, you know, on 18-wheelers rolling in from as far away as Florida to California to try to, manage the pollination needs of the crop. People love almonds, I guess.
Alexis, it's been so interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Alexi Barrionuevo is a reporter for the New York Times. We have a link to his article on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. You don't need bees to make steak, but you do need cows. The FDA recently decided to allow sales of cloned beef in this country. This is meat from animals whose parent has been cloned. I've eaten it. Yes, I have actually eaten it. I'll tell you about it next and all the implications of allowing more manipulated food into our food supply. That's next when Good Food continues. Recently, I was asked to be part of a tasting panel of beef that had a cloned animal as a father. So I wanted to get a bit more on all sides of the debate for and against cloned beef. Today, we'll be talking with Denise Caruso. She's founder and executive director of the Hybrid Vigor Institute. The Institute's a nonprofit think tank that's dedicated to collaborative problem solving in the areas of infectious disease, environmental issues, and the risks of science and technology breakthroughs. So let's start simply. What is a cloned animal?
Well, cloning is a pretty radical technology. Rather than conception by a sperm and an egg, the cloning process, which is the one that produced the famous Dolly the sheep animal, is when a researcher extracts a nucleus from a donor cell and inserts the nucleus of the cell into an egg that's had its original nucleus removed. And then they apply a mild electric shock, and it tricks the egg into thinking that it's been fertilized. And then it gets inserted into the womb of a surrogate mother, and then an embryo with genes that are identical to the donor begins to develop.
Now, why are we cloning animals?
The reason that I believe that the agriculture industry is excited about it is, you know, they have prize beef. They want to reproduce the genes perfectly.
Where does the FDA stand on the issue of putting progeny of cloned beef into the food supply?
Well, I mean, their determination, as far as I recall it, was the actual cloned animals themselves were safe to eat.
Do you think that they're in a position to make such an unequivocal statement?
Well, they're in the perfect position to make the statement because they're the FDA and they can say whatever they want. But in terms of the science to back up the statement, I don't believe that the FDA or the industry, the cattle industry that's producing the cloned animals, is in a position to make that statement. And it's not because I necessarily believe that the meat or milk from cloned animals is not safe. But the methods that the government agencies and the industry use to make the determinations about risk or safety are really flawed, and they've been needing an overhaul for a very long time, and they haven't gotten one.
Why is the process for decision-making flawed, in your opinion?
none of the government agencies seem to be practicing the more modern methods of risk assessment that have been recommended to them by the National Academies, which is the, you know, that it's the group that's the scientific advisors basically to the agencies. And what the National Academies said in a report that they published on, I think it was called the Safety of Genetically Modified Food, was that the metric that the FDA uses today, which is nutritional equivalence, is not really a modern enough measurement for biotech genetically engineered food.
You know, we hear a lot about genetic diversity as a good thing and something to try and attain lately. And one of the things that really struck me when I was at the roundtable on cloning is how easy it would be for cloning very productive, vigorous, important animals, how it can just lead to so much less diversity.
The idea I think you're referring to there is called monoculture. And monocultures are bad in any ecosystem, whether it's animals or plants. That robust DNA wouldn't stay robust for long if you kept cloning and cloning and cloning the same animal. And in fact, one of the things that I find kind of interesting in terms of the kind of risk assessments that don't get done are the long-term studies of what happens to these animals over time. If you have read any of the literature about cloning in the lab and, you know, researchers who do cloning, I mean, it's incredibly difficult and the failure rate is staggering. Like one in several thousand will actually take.
In your opinion, what would be the optimal way to test the cloning process?
Well, I think that the optimal way to do any kind of risk assessment is to invite more people in the room than the people who invented the technology and the regulators. There's a method that's been proposed for many years by risk experts that is a collaborative, interdisciplinary, many experts from many disciplines process. Come to a table and say, okay, the problem on the table is cloning animals for food. And you actually ask people for their expert opinions about how these animals will grow up in the real world, not in the lab, and how farmers and ranchers are likely to be able to take care of them or not take care of them so that they will be healthy or not healthy. I mean, there are lots and lots of questions that get asked in a larger context that are really important to deciding whether or not a food is safe.
Denise, it's been really interesting talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Denise Caruso is founder and executive director of the Hybrid Vigor Institute, a nonprofit think tank dedicated to the areas of infectious disease, environmental issues, and the risks of science and technology breakthroughs. We've been talking about cloned meat. In the upcoming weeks, I'll be following this issue on the show. I'll be talking soon with a scientist about the implications of cloning on our medical industry and other unintended consequences. Since the idea of cloned meat can be repellent, you could always go vegetarian. There's a long history with this ism. I'll tell you about vegetarianism's colorful past next, here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Vegetarian, a word that can conjure up many images, many personalities, many reasons for turning away from animal flesh for food. But where does our cultural frame of reference come from for vegetarianism? Tristram Stewart is the author of The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times. Welcome, Tristram.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, Tristram, take us to the beginning of the word vegetarian.
Okay, well, the word vegetarian was coined in the 1840s. 1842 is the first recorded instance. Before that time, the issue of whether we should be eating meat or not was an open philosophical question which involved many thinkers from all sorts of different walks of life. There were scientists and philosophers and theologians all wrangled over the issue. It was only in the 19th century that the movement gained a name, vegetarianism, and it became more or less an identity. And once something becomes an identity, I think it's very easy to cordon it off and pigeonhole it. I think that, to some extent, closed it off from a wider debate.
Now, of course, we're talking about, in terms of your research, a cultural history from the Western point of view.
That's correct. One of the most surprising and exciting things that I found in my research was actually the degree of influence that India had on Western culture. So when Europeans first started traveling to India in any large numbers in the late 1600s, one of the things that fascinated them most was the Indian vegetarians. It provided a radical challenge to the Western Christian idea that man had dominion over nature and nothing had any value except insofar as it was useful to humans.
Now, who were some of the names that we would recognize that were very visible in this debate?
Well, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, one of the most famous vegetarians was Percy Bysshe Shelley, the poet. He was also a political agitator, and he joined a group of nudist vegetarians in Berkshire, and they believed...
What an image!
Well, exactly. In fact, nudism and vegetarianism go together throughout history. I think a lot of vegetarians who were perhaps sometimes quite extreme in their views thought that they could get back to nature by putting on their birthday suits.
It was very cold to do that in England.
Well, that's right, and that was, of course, the main argument against it. But certainly the vegetarian argument remained in place.
Now, a lot of people who are meat eaters and omnivores will say that if you go back to Paleolithic times, we basically are omnivores.
Of course we are. We've been evolving to hunt and kill for the last at least 2 million years. And that, of course, was a fact that was disputed by vegetarians throughout history. But most of the evidence suggests that we were at least extremely efficient hunters 500,000 years ago and probably well before. But that, of course, is no justification for continuing to eat meat in the levels that we do. If you look at what humans have done for the last 50,000 years as we spread out over the globe, whenever we've arrived in a small island or even continents, one of the first things we've done is very rapidly wiped out a large sector of the large edible mammals. We've proceeded to change the environment and sometimes depleting our own resource base such that our civilizations in various different parts of the world have collapsed. And one of the main drivers for environmental degradation is meat production. It's a very inefficient way of producing food. And so even if you don't believe that we have to become vegetarian, we can at least recognize that if we're going to stop destroying our own planet, then meat eating is one of the things we're going to have to start looking at, just as we're beginning to look at use of fossil fuels.
You know, one of the things that's most interesting in your book is throughout it, there's a litany of names that are sometimes quite surprising of people who embraced vegetarianism and their various reasons. For example, Hitler, I think, is one of those folks who I think often people would be surprised to find out that he was a vegetarian.
Well, yes, but the ideas behind people's vegetarianism vary immensely. So you can look, and I do in my epilogue, at the two contemporaneous figures, Hitler and Gandhi. They were both vegetarian, but how different they were politically, my God. So vegetarianism doesn't actually tell you anything about what a character is going to be like or what their politics is going to be. Hitler, for example, thought that vegetarianism would help to purify his own body and even apparently the human race. And of course, fascism has a lot to say about purification. But also for Gandhi, vegetarianism was about a peaceful relationship between all humans and animals also.
And I understand that, in fact, he rebelled against vegetarianism for a certain period of his life.
Well, yes, absolutely. He succumbed to the British imperial idea that meat made you strong. And therefore, if the Indians were going to become strong enough to kick out the British, then they had to eat meat like the British. Ironically, when he went to London and he encountered the Vegetarian Society there, in the 1880s, that's when he became politically convinced that vegetarianism was actually potentially a source of power and resistance against the British.
What were the social and political reasons for vegetarianism at this point?
What my book shows is that many of the political and environmental and animal rights perspectives that were developed and are current today were actually started during the 1600s and 1700s. So you get the whole spectrum of ideas. You have people who simply think it's morally wrong to kill an animal. You get people who say it's inefficient to grow grains and then feed them to cattle and other animals because most of the nutrition in those grains is thereby converted into feces and heat. That was a really big argument, especially at the end of the 18th century, and has become a really big argument now. Likewise, you had theologians who said we were not originally created to eat meat. So all of these different arguments were also current back then.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really happy to have this book as part of my library.
Thank you, Evan.
The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times, is the name of Tristram Stewart's fascinating book. Speaking of living healthy, one thing we can do in our diets is to eat more whole grains. Most of us have a hard time incorporating these things into our diet because some grains are chewy and take forever to cook. Some advice from a grain expert next. They can taste good, really, I promise. That's when Good Food continues. Just a little note, I recorded this interview during a bout with laryngitis, so I sound a little strange. Dunn Gifford of Old Ways, an old friend of mine, is here to demystify whole grains and to help us find some simple ways to integrate them into our lives. Hi, Dunn. Why do you think most Americans are so whole grain averse?
Oh, I think, Evan, it's because it's unfamiliar, strange. You don't know how to cook it. You don't know what it is. You don't know if your children or your partner will want it or like it. It always has this reputation of, oh, those chewy, awful muffins that I saw those kind of weird people with long hair eating in the corner of the restaurant, you know?
Yeah, it's really terrible. It's like that 60s granola head attachment has never gone away. Boy, that has stuck. I have to say that I'm not the healthiest eater on the planet because I just am such an omnivore. But one thing I do love is whole grains because I love the chewiness and the nuttiness of them.
Well, that's once you get people to understand that and try it a few times, they go right to it. There's nothing quite like a whole wheat or bulgur salad, cold salad with the, you know, that's been boiled to its the right tenderness, and you put little orange slices in it and slivered almonds and things. And people just, once they have it, they say, man, this is wonderful. It tastes so good and it's so sweet. But, of course, it's the perfect thing. You have your fruit. You have your whole grains. You have a little oil from the slivered almonds or something like that. It's almost perfectly balanced.
You know, it's funny. I've sort of fallen into a rhythm of once a week cooking about a pound of whole grain, whatever I decided is that week, if it's farro or if it's kamut or quinoa. And I'll just boil it and put it in a little Ziploc bag, and I'll add it to salads throughout the week. And I find that I crave less flesh, less, you know, fatty meats when I'm eating a lot of whole grains.
Do you put a little oil on it of some kind? Or
I just throw it into whatever. So I make a salad all the time that I sort of call my garbage salad, where I throw in greens and avocados and fennel, whatever I have. And then the standard dressing du jour at my house is a Parmesan vinaigrette. So it's very garlicky, very cheesy. And
ooh, it sounds wonderful, but it's got some nice fat in it from the cheese. That's the perfect match. I mean, you want to try to eat from the three great nutrient groups, the carbohydrates and the fats and the proteins and things like that as you go through your day. And so it's the whole grains gives you a way to do that. It's wonderful, wonderful tastes.
What should they be replacing in our diet?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's those big muffins you see on the 11 o'clock coffee break in the cafeteria and in most of the workplaces in America. And the big plate of rolls that comes out that when you go to a restaurant, what do they plop down right on the table between you? A big plate of rolls. And it is those kinds of rolls and muffins that are made from refined white flour that are not as health promoting as if the same thing were done with whole grain flour or whole grains themselves as a salad or something.
So is it really that much more beneficial for us to eat, like, let's say, a bread or a roll, but just with the whole grain flour, the nutritional benefits still remain so much better than a milled white flour?
Oh, that's absolutely right, because to make a white flour, you strip off the bran, the brown outside of the grain kernel, whether it be corn, which is yellow, wheat, which is brown, wild rice, which is really kind of blackish, and so on. So if you strip all that away, you are subtracting out some very important parts of the nutrient profile of the whole grain. There's the endosperm. You know, a grain really has three parts, the germ, the endosperm, and the bran. And the best, most nutritious way to eat those is as our ancestors 100,000 years did, who made our gene code, which is to eat all of it. And so the more you refine it, the less value it has nutritionally.
John Gifford is the founder of Old Ways Preservation Trust. Old Ways is a nonprofit food issues think tank that develops and carries out education programs and events to help consumers make wise choices about eating, drinking, lifestyle, and the traditional pleasures of the table. They've got a new book out. It's called The Old Ways Table. Many an entrepreneur has cooked their way out of poverty, but these days health and business regulations can stifle a person's ability to start a new business. Next, a unique organization that helps people get over these hurdles. Stay tuned. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. What happens if you have a dream of selling a treasured family recipe, which is wildly appreciated by all your friends and coworkers, but you have no resources to work with? Some interesting nonprofits have stepped in to help pave the way to success in food service for immigrant women. Here in L.A., there's Mama's Hot Tamales near MacArthur Park, and in San Francisco, there's La Cocina. Caleb Ziggis is the program director of La Cocina Community Kitchen, a nonprofit shared-use commercial kitchen and business incubator. Welcome, Caleb.
Thanks. Hi.
Explain to us exactly what La Cocina is.
So La Cocina is a nonprofit incubator kitchen, and we essentially provide commercial kitchen space and technical assistance to entrepreneurs who are launching their food businesses. So we work with them to either grow, expand, or formalize their food businesses.
How long have you been in business?
La Cocina opened its doors 2 years ago, although the original feasibility study began in 1999. So there's been a little bit of work behind actually launching the program.
And why was it founded?
It was founded, this feasibility study specifically studied the Mission District in San Francisco, which is a primary Latino neighborhood, and found that there were several sort of business planning organizations that were around. And a lot of the business plans, actually most of the business plans coming out of those classes were directed at opening food businesses. But after the business planning class was finished, a lot of the women who wanted to open up their restaurants or their commercial spaces couldn't actually find affordable or accessible commercial kitchen space. So the business plan would sort of end at the planning stage.
So is that a lot of what you do? It isn't just that people come in and they immediately start cooking their recipes in your kitchen. You have quite a lengthy application process, don't you?
We do. It's a significant screening process. I mean, we look for people who are either already selling informally or have a very strong business plan. If they don't have a business plan when they come to us, we generally work with our partner organizations in order to do some of the business planning part. And then once they reapply with us with the business plan in hand, we go through a 3 to 6 month sort of pre-incubation period where we knock down what we see as the major benchmarks in launching a business, from licenses and permitting to scaling recipes to marketing ideas. And then we launch after that 6 month period.
Is there a point where they graduate out of your program and out of your kitchen?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole incubation model really is designed that the businesses spend no more than, say, 1 to 4 years in our kitchen as an incubatee. And the idea is that they'll grow their business after launch to a point at which it becomes more viable or sustainable to go to a larger area, either their own space or a co-packer. A co-packer is somebody who basically takes the recipes, produces it, and bottles it for you.
Do you have a couple great stories for us? Maybe one person who started in your program that's now out doing very well, selling specialty products, and maybe another who's doing a farmer's market stand, for example.
Sure. There's two great examples. Our first graduate is Jill Litwin. Her business is called Peace of Mind, and we brought Jill in because she was focused, had an amazing product, and really had done the right kind of research into launching a food business. And she's recently graduated into a co-packer, and now you can find her product up and down the West Coast in Whole Foods. It's a frozen food for growing kids. They're called little puffets, and they're little mini casseroles for toddlers and growing kids. Then on the other side of the sort of hot food area, we have Veronica Salazar, who her business is El Huarache Loco. And she came also when we first opened to La Cocina. She had been cooking out of her home for a couple of years, making the sort of typical street food of Mexico City. And when she approached us, she said that, you know, in San Francisco, despite the, you know, large Latino population, nobody was really doing the kind of food that she remembered from Mexico City. And so she'd found this niche market where people would drive in 45 minutes, an hour to eat in her house. So she came to us with this idea, and we went to her house, to see what the operation looked like. And it really was totally informal. And there's something great about that informality. There's something, you know, it feels like someone's really cooking for you, which is a lot of what you want when you go out. So we directed her towards Alas, and she took a business planning class in San Francisco. That's a program of the Women's Initiative. And then we hooked her up with the Alemany Farmers Market, which is the longest running market in San Francisco, and worked with their market manager and launched a food booth there where she's doing hot foods. And immediately it took off. She got noticed by the San Francisco Chronicle, and now she's doing 2 days a week at this outdoor market in a booth and selling something like $1,500 worth of food every day.
Now, do graduates tend to come back and sort of put some work back into the program by being mentors of new arrivals?
Yeah, the graduates who leave, we really try and get them to come back. And right now we have two of them, so it's been pretty easy to get both of them to do it, to come back and be our advisory committee members. And the advisory committee members are the ones who are really active during that six-month pre-application process. Basically, they work with the businesses as they come in to identify, you know, potential problem areas with the business that need to be worked out before launch. And that's really helpful since they've been there before.
As someone who's involved with the program, what are a few of the things that keep you engaged that you really love about this kind of incubator?
I mean, the greatest thing, hands down, is that it's this program that's really dedicated to bringing high-quality, authentic food to a community that loves food and doing it with the people who make it the best and who've always made it the best. And sometimes, like anyone who knows food business, the people who make their food the best or who care the most about their food have a really hard time running their own food business. And as a result, you don't always get the best food on the market. So it's really great to be able to be a place where you can find this great food products and people who really want to make this what they do for their lives and work with them to make sure that it's something viable for them and their families as a model.
This has been really interesting. Thank you so much, Caleb.
You're welcome. Come to San Francisco and taste our food.
I definitely will. La Cocina Community Kitchen is located in San Francisco. I've got a link to their site and what they do on our website at ksrw.com/goodfood. There's always room on Good Food to talk to people who found their souls over a plate of food, especially when that food is eaten in a beautiful foreign city. Next, soul searching in Rome. Stay tuned. A nasty divorce leaves a woman emotionally battered and physically depleted. She takes a year of her life to heal and reassess, methodically dividing the year into time to eat, to pray, and to love. Writer Elizabeth Gilbert turns this painful scenario into pure gold in her best-selling book, Eat, Pray, Love, One Woman's Search for Everything Across Italy, India, and Indonesia. We, of course, want to hear about the eating part. When you first started this year's jaunt, what made you decide to begin in Italy?
You know, it's kind of funny. For this, I have to tell you an anecdote. I was doing a reading recently for the book, and an Italian woman, a woman from Bologna, was in the audience. And she came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Can I just ask you a question? Why do so many American women come to Italy after they get divorced?" She said, "The streets of Italy are like paved with brokenhearted American recent divorcees." And I think I'm just one of many people who somehow found the idea of Italy somehow just very sustaining, you know? I think part of it has to do literally with hunger. You know, you're bereft, you're alone, and food has always been such a comfort for the sad. And I think the romance of Italy coupled with the food of Italy makes it a logical place to go to heal.
Who started to take you out? Did you have an initial guide, someone you knew who sort of helped you get your feet wet and find the culinary ropes, so to speak?
You know, initially I didn't. I had no contacts in Rome. But very quickly I started to ask people where to eat. You know, that was like one of the first sentences that I made myself learn in Italian was to ask people, "Where is the best food around here?" And then to let them point me to it. So my initial culinary guides to Rome were bus drivers, you know, other waiters at restaurants where I'd say, "Well, where else is wonderful to eat?" And of course, my teachers at the language school. And that's how I met my friend Giovanni, who is this beautiful 25-year-old Italian boy who just grew up in Rome and knew all the sort of wonderful cheap places to eat. And so that was my second phase, was just finding all these places with sort of plastic tablecloths on back streets of Rome.
Do you have a moment in which you were eating where you just exhaled and you said, "Now I can feel myself reconfiguring and just feeling better"?
I had several moments like that. I think it's I think for anybody who's coming out of a divorce and a depression, it's kind of like a series of exhales, you know, each one deeper than the last. And, you know, I definitely remember my first meal, you know, getting off the plane early in the morning and going to my new home and getting the keys from the landlord and putting down my luggage and then going out onto the streets. And it was a rainy September day and just walking into just an average trattoria and sitting down and having some pasta with salmon sauce and a you know, half a bottle of wine just for me and some incredible bread. And, you know, just sitting there and thinking, "God, I did it." You know, I'm here and I've got 4 more months of eating ahead of me. This is wonderful. But probably the most transcendent meal that I had in Italy, there's two that come to mind. One was the pizza in Naples, which really was just, you know, godly, at this place called Pizzeria da Michele, which is one of the most famous pizzerias in Italy. And just changed entirely my view about pizza. Like, I didn't know that you could have thin, soft crust on pizza. I thought you could only have thin, crispy crust or thick, soft crust, but they sort of reinvented pizza for me. And the other was when I was in Sicily at the end of my trip, and I found just a small family restaurant and watched the mother and grandmother and aunts in this little family place just prepare the most exquisite seafood.
I would imagine that you started to acquire habits that were quite different from your daily eating habits back in New York. Let's take breakfast, for example. What did you eat for breakfast in New York?
Well, I was a big yogi and a big healthy person, and so my typical breakfast in New York would be, you know, goat's milk yogurt with wheat germ and, you know, some sort of protein shake and, you know, followed maybe by some sort of horrible protein bar. In Italy, on the other hand, I had a favorite square that I would go to every morning. I would buy the newspaper and I would sit outside and I would have a cappuccino and I would have one or maybe two pastries and then another cappuccino and then maybe just one more. And one thing that I love about Italy, one little story that I have is that every day I would go to go up to the counter and order my cappuccino and I would talk to the same waiter and every day I would ask him to make it very hot because they would tend to serve it sort of tepid. So I would, you know, say molto caldo, you know, please could you make it very hot? And then one morning he just put up his finger and said nothing, you know, like wouldn't let me speak, and he brought me my cappuccino and he had written in the foam of the cappuccino the word caldo, hot. And I thought, you know, how can you beat this? You know, this is why we love Italy.
Now, you went from Italy to India. Was going from one to the other a very strange adjustment?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny to go from eating veal and drinking wine in Venice to suddenly, you know, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning for a day of serious, rigorous meditation. In a way, it was a perfect continuation, and I'll explain why. My effort in Italy, what I was trying to do was to just indulge myself in 4 months of pure pleasure without holding back anything. And so the food was definitely my bridge into that. In India, I was going on a very serious spiritual journey. I was living in an ashram in a community where everybody was also on a very serious spiritual journey. And the food in the ashram was phenomenally good for that purpose. You know, it was food that had been sort of Ayurvedically designed to strengthen the body and calm the spirit and sort of get you in a place where you could spend 4 hours a day in stillness and meditation and you would be well taken care of internally as well.
Once you finally got back home after the entire voyage, were there any parts that you brought back to your kitchen and became a new sort of daily habit?
I would say taking time. I mean, the thing that joins Italian food and Indian food as great cuisines is how very much time it takes to do it properly, not just to make it properly, but to eat it properly. And that's the thing that I think in America we have to push so hard against is all of that cultural pressure that says that you have to do everything fast. You know, this is the kind of thing that I just will not participate in anymore. I will sit down on the park bench and slowly eat my bagel at the very least. And at the very most, I've tried to build a life that's very kitchen centric.
Thank you so much. Your book is just marvelous.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Eat, Pray, Love is Elizabeth Gilbert's book on travel, food, and finding herself. You can find out all the information from today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Subscribe to the Good Food audio and video podcast there too. You can see our videos on YouTube. Just search KCRW's Good Food. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. Special thanks to music supervisor Gary Messiha and to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you next week.